Hello and welcome to the Biz Trends 2024 report. I'm Danette Breitenbach, the editor of marketing and media at Biz Community. Today, it's my great pleasure to welcome back a firm favorite of the Biz Trends report, Bronwyn Williams of Flux Trends. Welcome, Bronwyn.
Thank you so much for inviting me back.
It's lovely to have you. Bronwyn is a well-known trend media personality and her reputation precedes her as a corporate consultant, futurist, financial and social economist. She's also the author of a few books, including her latest, Rescuing Our Republic. But today we are going to chat about tech, but with a refreshing spin as we examine techno-optimism, not acceleration, how to make friends with machines. So let's jump right in. Bronwyn, what does techno optimism. What does the concept mean?
It just essentially means that we can be optimistic about the trajectory of humanity and technology together. In other words, it's taking an optimistic view of the fact that technology, historically, for the greater part, and of course there are exceptions, has been together with progress. That's the purpose of technology. And if we can remember that, we can be optimistic about progress. That's not to say we should discount dangers or potential pitfalls, just like in regular optimism. Optimism isn't the same as blind faith. Optimism is backing the world that you want with the actions that you need to take in order to get there. And basically the choice opposed to techno-optimism is to be pessimistic about progress and technology. But that's not helpful. If we are pessimistic about technology and progress, then we're never going to try anything new. There's, in fact, a wonderful book that was recommended by one of my favorite authors, Terry Pratchett, called The Evolutionary Man, which shows that this idea of our natural bias against technology goes back to original cavemen days. And essentially, this short little homily follows a caveman family where the father is absolutely dead set against all new innovations like a spear or using fire, for example. Because what if you cut yourself? What could go wrong? But if you focus only on what can go wrong, you don't get progress. And if that was our mindset from the days of being cavemen, if we'd listen to Dad, never dabbled with fire or knives or anything dangerous and progressive, well, we'd still be sitting around the cold hearth without even a fire within it.
We would be. And I think it's quite nice that we're not. I can definitely vouch for that. But it does bring up something that's quite interesting, is because there is a natural fear of the unknown that I think we all have. And this year we've seen a lot of that, because suddenly we're talking AI and we've spoken about things like that. This year it really came to the fore because, of course, of ChatGPT. So how do you, and people, they want to be optimistic, I think, but I think there's a lot of fear. Will I lose my job? What will happen to the company? And how do we get people to overcome that fear of that tech?
Well, first, I think we need to look at the stories that we're telling ourselves about technology. Now, when you look at studies globally around techno-optimism versus techno-pessimism, in other words, countries where people see technology as an opportunity to help them progress, to help them get out of poverty, to help them improve their lifespans and their life quality of life, so the quality and quantity of life, as opposed to people who see technology as a threat, it's quite interesting that a lot of the Eastern and the so-called Global South communities, where economies are still literally developing, are excited about technology and more optimistic about that. Whereas the more developed, wealthier world, people tend to be more pessimistic because they kind of see technology as perhaps threatening the lives they already have, as opposed to people who have less, who see technology as a way to have what they do not have yet or to get ahead in life, right? So I think that's, first of all, interesting thing to say. I think that does come down to the stories that we also tell about technology in our communities. In the Western tradition, most of our stories that talk about advanced technology tend towards the dystopian. Whether you're talking about like Brave New World or 1984, the sort of classic dystopian kind of science fiction homilies that we're so used to, or whether you look at movies like, of course, Terminator, for example, we have these ideas of like technology being quite dangerous and humanity having to conquer it rather than work with it. Whereas if you look at a lot more Eastern technology, you actually see technology as being the means for the hero to save the world. So I think that the sort of the three body problem is kind of a classic in that genre that I think many people would be familiar with right now. But it's just this very difference in the stories we tell. And the stories we tell shape our belief in the future, and our belief in the future shapes our actions towards the future. So if you believe things are going to be doom and gloom and quite pessimistic, then you're going to sort of fall into that trap. Whereas if you see it as being an opportunity, you're going to embrace these technologies in very different ways. But I think it's also worth kind of putting a pin in this conversation here and talking about another sort of subtle form of pessimism that can disguise itself as hyper-optimism, but is actually fundamentally anti-human. And this is an idea and a philosophy that's come out of the West at the moment, that of the accelerationist movement that you referred to at the beginning of this conversation. So the likes of Marc Andreessen, the very famous investor that's obviously involved with a lot of cutting-edge technology, is perhaps becoming the sort of poster boy of these conversations around the accelerationist or EAC movement, as you might have seen it mentioned on social media. And here it's talking about this idea that we should move fast and break things, like we did with social media, but on a much greater scale with technology, and that it doesn't actually matter if what is broken is the entirety of the human experience. That's the sort of extremist view of this so-called techno-progressivism, but it's not necessarily optimistic. And I like to sort of separate those two thoughts. You can be excited about technology without believing that technology should be adopted and employed regardless of the consequences that it has for humanity. In fact, the sort of the far future versions and thinking of the e-accelerationist movement is that technology should supersede humanity and that we should accelerate to that point as quickly as possible. And it doesn't matter if humanity is taken over by some sort of machine offspring that becomes a machine god. Of course, we are delving into the realm of science fiction. They please do not get panicked and excited about this. This is the whole point of my message, but rather say we need to challenge those sorts of narratives. But that's the idea, and I would suggest that that's actually quite a pessimistic view because it suggests that humanity is flawed and that it's not worth saving or protecting, and that technology is still then antithetical to humanity or opposed to us rather than something that we can embrace and work together, as has been the history of humanity and technology, which has been largely a history of progress, which of course some technology is ending up in very wrong hands and causing great destruction. We shouldn't forget that, but overall, generally, our lives are much better today than they were even a century ago. You look at the pictures of people, even in the Netherlands, who used to live in effectively like squatter camps, and now look how developed that country is. And if we look at the problems in our own society here in South Africa, we have to say, how did other countries get out of it? Well, it was through embracing technology, embracing progress, and moving forward. So we should never throw the baby out with the bathwater. We have to have healthy, pragmatic optimism when we look at the future of humanity and technology.
How do we use this on the continent? I think a favorite question.
Well, that's a big question. Well, how do you use any technology? Well, you have to start to understand it. You have to work with it. You have to play with it. And you have to see it as all technologies have been in history, as a tool. And as tools that can be used for good or for ill, but tools that can and will enhance what we are doing anyway. So they will give us greater speed and greater scope to do the things that we are doing with them, whether those are good things or whether they are bad things. But we have to be part of that. We have to be part of that conversation. We certainly shouldn't shun these technologies because other parts of the world and other people, individuals in our communities are embracing them and using them to further their own ends, whether they be commercial ends or ends towards power and politics or whatever the case might be. We need to use the tools and technologies around us to essentially cast our own votes on the futures that we want to be a part of. So that's the sort of the very grandiose kind of answer here. The sort of the simpler one would be we need to get technologically literate. And the sort of base case scenario that might be holding us back here in South Africa is that to get technologically literate, you have to have access to technology. In order to have access to technology, you have to have access to things like Wi-Fi, which still not everyone has. We know our data prices are sky high here. If you're a corporate working in that space to solve that problem, it's going to be in all of our interest. And more fundamentally than that, in order to even access Wi-Fi, you need electricity. So we need like literal power to keep the lights on so we can access these tools that really are so democratized and should be leveling the playing field according to access to opportunity globally for people locally. But we can only do that if we get the basic fundamentals right first.
That's very true. You can't kind of take advantage of this if you don't have your foundation in place. How do you see this going forward, though? What are the trends that are going to come out of this? And what direction do you think it's going to take us? Because you've kind of sketched two scenarios, a very positive one and then a little bit more of a negative one. So where do you see it going, and what do you see the trends coming out of this?
Well, overall, the future is never going to be quite as good as we hope or as bad as we fear. I mean, like the future is kind of like tomorrow, right? There's things that'll go wrong and there's things that'll go right, but we keep on moving on. So I'm not here to paint very utopian or very dystopian pictures. And in fact, my first piece of advice would be to push back against anyone who is painting a very binary picture of the future, whether it is very rosy or, of course, very disastrous. Those are likely red flags. This is not someone that has spent a lot of time thinking about the way that the world is heading. But what we do have to understand is that the sort of technologies that we've created for ourselves right now do allow us to essentially have what we want when we want it. And in fact, if you look back at human history, that's kind of been the progress of technology, giving us more of what we want faster. Whether you're looking at the on-demand economy and the way we can now get groceries back at our doors, this is another sort of back to the future trend, just as a bit of an aside there. But we can get what we want when we want it in the physical world. We can now get what we want when we want it in the more digital world without having to go through so many middlemen. So it's actually very similar. There's lots of parallels with the on-demand gig-based economy where you can order what you want on an app in the physical world and get delivered to your door. These technologies allow us to get what we want in the digital realm without having to go through digital gatekeepers, right? You can now use these natural language processing tools to process and get the answers you need out of information that's already out there in the world, right? So you can get the answers that you need. You can get a picture that you want done instead of having to scroll through, databases of licensed stock photography images to hopefully find something that kind of matches with the picture in your head. You can just prompt, get and dictate and creative direct that yourself. This gives such power to people in advertising and creative fields that you can be your own creative director. You don't have to rely on someone else's interpretation of what you're thinking. No. So we do have a lot of power for a lot of efficiency over there that we're going to see more of. And we are going to also see this increasing ability to have personalized and individualized. It's again very similar parallels to what's going on in the sort of FMCG world and has been for quite a long time now. But personalized on-demand content, advertising, services, offers, there's going to be so much more of that. So just think about whatever you want when you want it. The generative economy is very sort of disruptive in that regard, and that's what we're going to get. Again, kind of for better or for worse, there's of course ways to manipulate these things too. And there are also a lot of traps we need to avoid falling into, particularly as businesses or people that want to operate in the creative advertising or marketing space. We can't be too reliant on new generative technologies to generate new ideas. If we see them as essentially being sort of almost filing systems to go back and get the best of or to cherry-pick information from the past, from the global consciousness to sort of pick the global brain, fantastic. But if you're relying on them to come up with new ideas, you're perhaps going to have a few challenges there in that anything technological, anything digital is reliant on past behavior and past performance. And as I know, as both an economist and a futurist, past performance is no guarantee of future return. So I think that on the one hand, we are becoming more and more godlike. We have this power and ability to create words and pictures and movies and music, which is amazing. It is magical powers. Anyone from a couple of centuries ago would think it's absolute magical power to sort of generate clothes on demand, filters, change your age, change your hairstyle. It really is extraordinary. But at the same time, we shouldn't fall into the trap of believing the gods or the magical powers we have instilled upon ourselves are in fact oracles of truth or somehow wiser and more knowledgeable than us, as opposed to being kind of a dark mirror of our kind of collective intelligence. So yes, we are gods. It is magic that we can do, but at the same time, the tools that we're using to perform this magic are not magical in and of themselves. So we shouldn't be sort of tricked into believing that these systems that we interact with that do these magical things are godlike or immutable or unfalsifiable. Because that's, of course, something else we've seen hugely this year, that we can't rely on anything. Because anything digital still relies on an input which can be falsified, which can be flawed. And we need to sort of check and balance our sort of expectations going forward. So massive opportunities, but also massive opportunities to perhaps fall into the traps of believing things that don't necessarily exist.
That brings us to an interesting point. False media, false news, being able to put somebody's image on top of something. How are we going to combat this?
Well, we're going to combat this by remembering the difference between the real and the illusion, remembering the difference between being an audience member and enjoying a magic show, and then stepping out into the sunlight again and realizing what is real and what is true. I've been talking to lots of businesses and lots of individuals about this over the last few years, and that's that we've kind of got this idea, and we've tricked ourselves into believing that digital information, whether that be an output from a calculation, from an economic forecast, from an AI output now from ChatGPT, whatever it may be, is true. And that what is digital is evidence of evidence. But that's not the fact at all. Anything digital has been compressed, it has been flattened, it has been manipulated, even if not badly, intentionally. Just this conversation we're having right now, we're talking to each other through a screen and the video is being compressed. I mean, I look a lot younger than I do in real life. You know, like our wrinkles aren't there, right? Our skin tone looks a lot smoother. You know, it's not true, but it's kind of sort of real. But the digital image is a flattened representation of reality. And any piece of information, whether that be evidence taken from a statement, from a witness, whether that be a mathematical calculation, is subject to error on the inputting side. And once it becomes processed through an algorithm, through some sort of AI system, through being put onto a blockchain, even if you want to get into the crypto space, all these digital things that we see are subject to vulnerability. It's a very human vulnerability. All the weaknesses are on the on-ramps and off-ramps, as I like to say, whether you're dealing with AI systems or crypto systems. Nothing digital is truth. It can be used perhaps as a proxy of truth or true enough to build other assumptions upon, but we should never fool ourselves that anything digital is in fact evidence of reality. And if you want really serious examples of this, like all the footage that's come out of the war in Gaza. It can be so manipulated. Even if the footage is real, the story that it is presented from or the source it came from could have been manipulated. Likewise, it could actually not be true. It could be manipulated content in the first place. So it's both the context and the media. We're going to need to develop a lot more media literacy, and we're going to need to teach our children that nothing digital is true. You have to actually come back to good old-fashioned judgment when it actually comes to making decisions. And this is something that humans are both good and bad at. We're good at making snap judgments in terms of that sort of system one thinking we have, where we have these natural heuristics that allow us to suspect or to trust people out of the box. We have our intuition we try and rely on. And that gets us most of the way. But of course, there's biases in that too. But that's the point. Human biases creep into our digital systems too and become perpetuated. And then lies somehow become laundered into truth in our minds because we have forgotten that the digital magic that we have created is, in fact, our own creation. It's not superior to us, it's actually, in many ways, inferior to us.
Thanks, Pauline. That's really interesting. And I'm wondering, will all this technology actually highlight our humanity more?
It can, it absolutely can, but that's not to say that it will. I think that that's also very important to note. Like, I know nuclear is very much back on the table in terms of my trend that I'm looking at, and it's back on the table both in terms of being revisited as a source of sustainable and, quite frankly, quite good for the planet's energy going forward, according to many scientists. It is still quite controversial given its history, but it's back on the table for doing good, at least in theory. The people that are proposing that it be taken forward are doing it to try and get lower costs, less environmentally destructive energy to more people. That's a good goal. Whether or not they're able to achieve it, it's a different story. I'm not here to debate the merits of nuclear. But at the same time, nuclear is back in the news in terms of the size of the stockpiles of nuclear warheads that have been found everywhere in like China and even us, although we demilitarized our nuclear, we still have access to large piles of it and stockpiles that we could remilitarize. And these sort of stories start to come back into consciousness. They're good to remind us of the conversation around digital technologies too, in that these technologies are powerful, they can be useful to us, but they can also be used and abused by us. And that's very much our sort of choice to determine what paths we take going forward. So in terms of technology helping us to find our humanity, there are great examples there. I think one of the case studies I pulled up for this conversation actually came back from some of the floods they had in Florida. So we all know climate's gone a bit crazy at the moment. It's very expensive out there. If you're a homeowner and you wake up one day and your house has been washed away, devastating. But what they managed to do with combining artificial intelligence with geolocation tracking data, again, something that makes people very, very scared, is what they were able to do is the day after these floods took place in Florida, they were able to airdrop the equivalence of, like, I think it was around 14,000 rand per person, who was known, thanks to the artificial intelligence system they used, to be a resident in that area. So you might be anti-surveillance, you might be anti-artificial intelligence, but it's hard to deny that in an emergency, instead of having to go through a process and go put in a claim with your government, like, remember the COVID grants here? You had school teachers who don't even have a bank account but were unable to claim the COVID grant unless they opened a bank account with 5,000 rand they didn't have, right? Now, this sort of system solves that problem. It's a very human problem that's being solved using technology. You were in that area. You clearly, based on inferences that the AI system says, are likely a victim. Here's the money, no questions asked, right? So, like, if we can take all these things, whether it's surveillance, whether it's AI, whether it's nuclear, and we can use them for nice things or for nasty things. And it's very much our choices as individuals, what sort of technologies we use ourselves, which ones we pay for, which companies we invest in, and also then in terms of what sort of politicians we vote for and what sort of bills we're prepared to support. A lot of the bills governing the new artificial intelligence systems and our digital rights are bills that are put out for public comments. I mean, there's some at the moment now, the GLAB bill and the new amendments to RICA, for example, which sort of touch on digital rights going forward. These are things that if you are seeing the conversation, you shouldn't get involved with that conversation and shape that legislation in a way that gives us more protections, not just for yourself, but for your neighbors and your society too. So that's a sort of, again, it's a very big conversation, but that's a short answer there.
Given that we're going into 2024 and we've had sort of a year of this explosion of these different technologies, what do you see as the three biggest trends in 2024 taking off?
Yeah, so the first one would be absolutely artificial intelligence regulation in terms of who's allowed to use it, who's not allowed to use it. That's a debate that's already started this year. We saw some very big hearings in Congress in the US, which tends to lead these things. The EU is also tabling some quite big bills there. But getting more formal and some test cases in terms of courts of law on the regulation around artificial intelligence will be a big trend to follow. We've kind of seen some small bellwethers this year in different directions, so I can give you examples. Some being actors or being authors that are now suing the artificial intelligence companies for essentially scraping their data to put into the algorithms that are used to form our outputs. There's going to be copyright tests, case studies there. There's also, of course, the continuation of the labor law protections. The likes of the writers' strike in the US, again, is quite a big bellwether. But the humans actually won against the machines. So I don't know if you know the outcome there, the Screenwriters Guild strike that went on for many months, the reasons why you've got so little content on your streaming services, because they stopped writing for like 6 months or something, right? So we've got to catch up there. But the human rights is won, essentially the right that studios in Hollywood that are part of the union's mandate over there will be not be allowed to use artificial intelligence to write programs. Only human guild union members will be able to write programs for Hollywood contracted studios. At the same time, the human rights has also won the rights to use AI themselves, which is really interesting, right? So it's a win for humans, but it's also a win for humans that understands the value of using technology but still protecting human rights. So we're going to see more and more of those debates. I hope the people following those stories look for the nuance there, the fact that yes, the humans won the case, but they also won the right to use it, because they kind of see that's also going to happen there. So anyway, the regulation versus innovation debate, a sort of accelerator brake conversation. We're going to see a bit more balance there. The other one we're going to see more of is synthetic relationships, as we term them. Again, there were quite a lot of signals that came out this year, but it's going to be a conversation that deepens. This is synthetic relationships, both past, present, and future. This is the things like rights to have essentially the open source contents to your digital friends' brains or consciousness. And this is sort of following the wake of things like digital girlfriends and boyfriends, which have become quite popular this year. Both digital boyfriends and girlfriends that are replicas of real people and entirely figments of the imagination. There's been a few interesting cases now where companies have stopped supporting the synthetic girlfriend or boyfriend app that you've now fallen in love with. And then you kind of like you're broken up with, even though you were paying, to have this relationship with this non-existent person. So this like follows on quite interestingly from like the open banking regulation in the EU. That's also now becoming more of a global, worldwide thing. There's an interesting case study here in South Africa too around open banking between Liberty and Discovery. And Liberty won the right to have that open data or the customer profile and loyalty profile of Vitality customers shared so people could have their own status that carries with them. This is kind of a self-sovereign identity conversation there, which I can get to in a minute for trait number three, but this idea of having the right to take your artificial girlfriend or boyfriend or friend or therapist's consciousness from the app that's no longer supporting it to a new app so that you can still own that relationship. Very interesting. But the fact that these synthetic relationships even exist, I'm not so sure that many of your listeners or readers or viewers are so familiar with that, but they're everywhere, and some of them are quite creepy. Some of them are actually synthetic versions of real people, as I said, not just of a, say, a model or celebrity that you like, that you want to sort of have a personal relationship with. They're also being used to create synthetic copies of your deceased or estranged family members, for example, right? So the sort of rights of synthetic relationships, expect more on this front. It could even be a new sort of relationship right conversation, like the rights that some women have had to marry themselves. In the future, there might be special rights for digital relationships and creatures. So it kind of touches onto the AI sort of side of things, but synthetic relationships are going to only get bigger, unfortunately. And then to link onto that again, I wanted to come back to that concept of self-sovereign identity, digital identity. That's a big global topic. There's legislation currently being sort of worked on in the EU to sort of formalize digital identity. And digital identity is a really interesting one. In fact, many countries are working on this, in that it touches on the edges of lots of conspiracy theories and people that are concerned about the power of governments. But at the same time, they also point towards much more efficiencies and much more fairness in terms of owning our own digital identities in an increasingly synthetic world, where, as I said, unfortunately, even though we shouldn't see what is digital as immutable truth, in effect, kind of is. Your digital identity and your digital presence, even if it is not a true replication of who you really are, is essentially becoming your passport or your key to access goods, services, and opportunities through the digital world and back into the real world. So conversations around self-sovereign identity, both the pros and the cons, and the digitization of that, whether that should be owned by the individual or by a company, or by your country, or what sort of compromises should be had there, those conversations are going to come into popular consciousness, and the sort of the legislation being shaped in the EU is likely to shape a lot of that conversation. That kind of ties back to trend number one around regulation and innovation. So yeah, synthetic relationships, digital identities, and regulation around innovation. Those are three things that I'd be keeping an eye on.
Brandon, I want to say thank you so much for your time today. It's been fascinating, not just I'm still stuck on the digital relationship thing. I'm definitely going to go check it out more. there was also a statement about looking better on screen or aging that I'm also going to go look into. So thank you so much. It's been fascinating. I think we could probably sit here all day. But thank you so much for your time, as always, for joining us again this year. And yeah, maybe we'll follow up with you again mid-year and see how it's going with these digital relationships. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
This is Danette Breitenbach from BizCommunity. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Bye-bye.